So here we are, a wonderful summer evening in a historical place, the House of the Cultures of the World, the center of world politics, is only 100 yards away. And we are as happy as you are that your wonderful book, an important book, got awarded the prize. All this becomes a story that we would like to narrate the production and translation of this book. Lena Müller, you probably enjoyed 2016 because you received this important prize, and other books translated by you are going to appear as well. Calcutta, the new book by Simona Sinha, and 83 by Varja, and the original edition of Let's Beat Up the Poor is projected here. Where did that happen and how? Well, I have told you I was in a bookstore in Paris. I had read an article about the book already, and I had already become aware of it. It was in my favorite bookstore, and the lady there recommended it to me. I read it, and after a first reading, I was, like many readers, probably fascinated without having analyzed it, actually, by the poetical language, the subjective and furious style that hit me very hard and created a sort of relief in me. Because at that time, I had already given the German asylum system a lot of thought. And the book narrates aspects that, in my perception, are not often published, public. And it creates an absurd situation to make people tell a story that is not their own story, because otherwise they don't fulfill the criteria. What this does to people, to have to narrate a story that has so many consequences on their future life, and also what it does to you to tell somebody else's story, that's a question that one might ask. How do you feel when you tell somebody else's life story in order to land in a different country? The situation is absurd. And I thought that also the first person narrator was quite exciting as a female protagonist who is so angry and who directs her fury outside. She's not very likable, but in her position as an interpreter who has a lot of power and at the same time no power at all, and who has to be a mediator where no mediation is actually possible between life situations and rules, regulations, and the bureaucracy. It became very apparent how difficult this situation is. I think we're going to get back to that also. We have a little library here on the table. I would like to show you this book. It looks as if it has a long history. What is it? This is the poetry anthology, Kalidas. The Bengali say Kalidas. And in other regions of India, you say Kalidasa. The old Indian poet wrote in Sanskrit. And it was translated in Bengali by a poet from the 60s, 70s, an important figure. So this is one of the books that I brought with me, that has lived with me. It's a very pretty book also. And there are some drawings. And the verse, four liners. It's the story of a being that is not entirely a human being nor a god. It's like an equivalent of an angel in the Indian mythology, who was banned from the royal court and was in exile. And he sent his mistress, probably his mistress, a message, a love message. And he found that the clouds were the messenger. It's a message through the whole of India to convey this message of love. It's already a metaphor. Images of poetry and love are already there in Indian poetry. That's where I come from, and without them I would not be here today. I carry this poetic, lyrical heritage inside me. And your closeness to poetry, you used to write also poems, and you translated poems. We're going to get back to that a bit later. This looks like a children's book. Yes, it is actually a book of short stories for children. It was written by Briak, an author. And when I was a child or a teenager in Western Bengal, where the Socialist Party was ruling, and student unions always spoke about the revolution, but they are a social democratic party. So I grew up in a region that was ruled by communists. And we had a strong cultural and literary and social link with the old Soviet Union. We would receive lots of books for children, grown-ups, teenagers, all the big Russian, famous Russian authors, but also Indian authors, Nikolai Ostrovsky and many others. This is the author who tells his story, Anushka, those stories. And my first contact with literature was through Russian literature. And I learned to love and hate and laugh and cry through this literature, because I was an only child, and my parents would leave me with neighbors or in the library. And from morning to night, all I would do is read. And I felt withdrawal symptoms when I had no books, because I was a word addict. The Russian literature, and of course American, French, and German literature are very important to me. Now, we have different influences here. From your origins, we heard that your parents were close to Marxism, and you also used to call yourself a Marxist when you were younger. Your relation to poetry and to those fantastic stories. And then there is a big break in your life. When you're 22 years old, you started to learn French. And you once said that it was like love at first sight. And in order to quote Charles Baudelaire again, love is as dangerous as a spoonful of acid on an empty stomach. So what did this love do to you, to your writing and to your life? Well, what did it do to me? I come from the Bengali literary culture. Yes, Tagore and Chandro and other Bengali authors with exotic names are very important authors from the 50s and 60s and 70s. But After a while, I started to feel like a lack. I started to write in Bengali language when I was 11 or 12 years old, and until I was 22 years old, I published some poems and prose. But after a while, I realized that there was no Jacques Derrida in Bengali literature, no Chomsky, no Kristeva, no Georges Bataille, no Marguerite Duras. I needed a real revolution in the Bengali language in order to feel an earthquake in the language, and I had not felt that in my mother tongue. And when I started to learn French, I came to Paris, and I was studying there, and I started to translate French poets into Bengali, and Henri Michaux, and then Lionel Rennes, and many others. And also the contrary, the Bengali poets into French. I translated a travel narrative, and I didn't make any leeway, and I was wondering why. Then I realized that unconsciously I was thinking in French and translating into Bengali, but the other way around, I couldn't manage. In my dreams, people from Calcutta came, and they spoke French. In 2008, I finished my first novel. It was published in French. But the French language is very important for me today, because everything that I said before, the revolution that is possible, things that are not possible in the Bengali language. As a woman, if I had continued to write in Bengali, I would have had all the weight of Indian society and tradition on my shoulders. I would not have that freedom of thought. And since I started writing and thinking in French, I have become somebody else, a free woman, a person who is free as a woman and as an author. And for me, language is not only a way, the means of expression, it's also substance and form. Even between me and the French language, there is still a certain distance. It's not perfect yet, but it is as if the structure that was being built. I am speaking French. It is not entirely finished, but I can remain in this imperfect structure within a language that is perfect. And I like this nascent, unfinished state that is not finished light. I have not become perfect yet. I am still nascent, but that's what I like. I owe to the French language everything that I am today and everything that I have acquired and achieved so far.
Let's stick with love again. What makes love so awful is the fact that it's a crime that you cannot commit without accomplices. So let us come to your accomplice, Lena Muller, and your working material. You made a map of metaphors and other visual depictions of the images. Let me explain how this works. Well, it's a kind of a mind map. It's not absolutely complete. I could have extended it, but what I noticed, I guess everybody who's read the book notices it too, there's a real wealth, sometimes almost a surfeit, of images and metaphors, and that's very important for the tone of the text. These images appear, they're buried, they crop up again elsewhere, and they hold the text together in a sense. So in order to grasp that and to be able to convey it too, I started to create this map with clusters of ideas, clusters of terms, the ideas of the clouds bubbling up together, the knots, the meshes, the clusters, and then the slightly ironic comments as well, the mocking comments, the blonde smiling, for example, the blonde thinking, and this white desire, this longing for whiteness, all of these ideas that run like leitmotifs through the text. And I had to unravel those for myself, first of all. And it's always a bit like that when you're translating. When you have a lot of images, you have to try to unravel them, pick them apart, to put them back together again with what the German language makes available. And of course, always trying, having looked at each individual part, to do justice to the overall picture. There's different levels. There's puns, there's language games. That's one level. So there's a joking element. Sometimes there are different semantic significances of a term, and trying to reconstruct that in German was part of what I had to do. So I spent quite a long time grappling with the book in those terms. But I realize it's really like a tightrope walk. You have to strike the right balance to make sure it never sounds kitschy. The German language is very sensitive to images being spot on. And there's a lot of very poetic, lyrical, and emotional images here. It was important for me not to make it too flowery and also to make it unkitschy, because the fury is the underpinning substratum. Well, yes, that is very important. These stories that are told, if they had ended up being full of pathos, it would really not have worked properly. Now, there's something else here in this pile of interesting things, photos. You sent a friend off to take photos of that opera. Well, they're very direct images. It's easy to understand them without any additional research. But when I first read this, it was also a novel about a city with a lot of images about the cityscape of Paris with its center flooded with light, with these peripheral areas, these transitional areas. We just heard about these big green doors. Anybody who's in Paris, ever been in Paris, will be able to remember that. When you have to really push hard against the door with all your weight to get it open, sometimes you won't be able to get the door open because there isn't enough space in the center of town for everybody who wants to live there, and they're pushed away to the peripheral areas, to the edges of the city, to the suburbs. And I found the images used for the cityscape very striking and very compelling. There's one passage where the opera is described. And a friend of me said, well, you know what? I live just around the corner from this opera. It's a real place, of course. And she went and took the photos for me. Maybe that one's even more striking, actually. The gray glazing soaring up to the high. The clouds reflected. That it fell apart and came together to create new planets. They penetrated into the glaze like the smoke of a fire, frightening and piercing, penetrating. You don't necessarily need the image, but it really helped me when I was translating it into German to really get a feeling for Paris and for the banlieue and to imagine these places. Now, the text describes all of this and everything else too in great detail. There's many descriptions of buildings and also of bodies. The corporeality of what the narrator experiences, it seems to me that this physicality is showcased by the text, almost as if to make it real, to say this is really real. Did you have that impression too, Sabine? Well, yes, it's a physical response to what was experienced. And Shimona told me that when she came in the evening after a long day interpreting, she'd start to write about what happened and really to write to get her fury out. It was a physical reaction. I had to do it, she said. And that is something that she's also transposed into the first-person narrator, reflecting her own experience. Now, expressing this experience that we don't necessarily want to grasp, we force asylum seekers to lie because otherwise they would have no chance to stay here. If, like the people from Bangladesh in France, I mean, Bangladesh is not counted as being a country from which you can get asylum. It's one of those so-called safe countries of origin. So the book takes a risk. It can be misunderstood. It describes the asylum seekers, in a sense, as liars. Now, the French reception of the book was very interesting, too. We've got some articles here that were about the book. When you see that in front of you, that kind of headline, did you think they understood your book at all? Where were the misunderstandings in all of that? Well, yes, yes and no. The drawing there is very interesting. There's a young woman wearing jeans and T-shirts and pushing, trying to hide in a cupboard, a woman who's dressed in a much more traditional way. So I found it really surprising. But I also think as well the headlines in the papers are often really to attract people's attention. They want to be eye-catching. Betrayal of oneself. I write as if I'm spitting. That was another headline. And if you ask me, these are headlines that are there to attract readers' attention. But back then, in 2010, 2011, people did pay a lot of attention. They were quite patient about engaging with it. So it was important, I thought, for the book to be written by somebody like me, who wasn't born within the French language, who has the ethnic origin, if I may put it in those terms, that I have. In a sense, it was like piercing an abscess. It's not manipulation. I mean, it wasn't manipulation. For example, it wasn't instrumentalized, for example, by the National Front, the infamous Front National in France. There were people who attacked me, but also who tried to get to grips with it from a progressive point of view. I was trying to understand what was happening. It's not just because people are in a dreadful state that they have to humiliate themselves. In Berlin last year, someone came to a reading with me and Lena, and she said that the book gave its dignity back to people who had lost it. And I thought that was a very important compliment, because without even realizing it, that was what I was trying to do through the book, in a sense. Political awareness. Political responsibility and political duty is something that's just in the hands of intellectuals, artists, the elites. Just because Bengali asylum seekers are poor and suffering, people think that they live almost like animals, that it's just all about eating, screwing, and sleeping. It's us who push them down to the lowest level of the hierarchy. But you have to hope, you have to demand as well to be treated like a human being, and to have your, and you have to cling on to your human dignity and your political view, not just about begging all the time and shouldering the dignity that you have, the dignity that's given to intellectuals. Lenin said this as well, as a matter of fact. There's something important about the working class maintaining their dignity and not just becoming petty criminals. A political duty is something which isn't just something that belongs to us. The proletariat also must have this political awareness. So I think that what I'm saying now is something I wasn't fully aware of when I was writing the book. It was almost like a physical reaction, a genuflection before the dreadful reality. But at the level of the paratext, I would say that political responsibility is on the shoulders of the entire populace. Think of Brexit as well, that proves somehow or other there's this real social caesura running through the country, the elite deciding for us. That's what's happening in France at the moment on labor law as well, and that shows what problems there are. The elite decides, and so we, the proletariat, are going to vote against that. And if we don't wait for the moment when the working class will start to really think in depth, there'll be enormous problems, that the social rupture, the social caesura, will be even more serious. There's one distinction which is very important. The book was published in France in 2011, and most of us in Germany, being naive, didn't think that we would be facing the challenge of so many asylum seekers in Germany so soon. We didn't think back then that we'd have to grapple with populists, that there would be hate speech against asylum seekers in Germany. We never thought that would be the case. Now, precisely in that mood you were translating, well, I wouldn't have proposed the book in 2015 any longer to any publishing house, actually. I would have felt it was inappropriate somehow. The asylum system, the way that it is in Germany, and has been for over 20 years, and in fact, the asylum law has been made even more stringent, but in essence, it's pretty much the same. There was this imbalance all the time. There were people who wanted asylum, who came to France, who came to Germany, but haven't got hope in hell of getting it. That was already the case in 2011 and 2012. And in 2014, 15, 16, public attention was suddenly directed once again much more to the asylum system from the media and also from the right wing. The right wing really put it in their sights. They say, oh, look, here come people, and they're telling stories that are not their own stories. They're telling lies. Here's these people. They'll be a burden on us. Here's these people who want something that we don't want to give them. That's what you saw in the media here. So in 2012, I wouldn't have thought that the discourse would go so sour and be so displaced. And in this kind of climate, I wouldn't have proposed the book any longer to a German publishing house, because the press reaction as well shows that again and again, people try to appropriate and say, ah, look, see, now even the literary people are saying this. They're saying that the people are lying. As if the Springer press hadn't written for the past 20 years that people tell lies when they apply for asylum. But literature is sometimes used to say, oh, look, look, this is evidence. I would have felt awkward about that. It would have been much too uncomfortable for me, because I think if you look properly and carefully at the book, the first person narrator is really the decisive figure. I think it's not easy for lots of people to grasp the structures of power and impotence, which overlap and are superimposed. It's not easy for people to grasp this structure. There's the gender issue, man, woman, the class question, educated, uneducated, rich, poor. There's also the former colonial power, France, and people coming from a country which was once a colony. The people who've always been natives in a particular country and the newcomers. I think all of these different strata make the book so complex. And when the mood is very het up, that makes it hard to defend the book because it's complex. Well, I think that is a book which precisely now should be presented to publishing houses. If it weren't published already, it really ought to be. There's one chapter, The Land Made of Clay. That describes how the situation is in Bangladesh, how people live there, and the reasons why they come to us, and what the situation is there. Well, yes, the climate catastrophe, which is having a dreadful impact there, gobbling up the land, eating away at the country. And there's no way to stay there for people. Over the course of the afternoon, we've heard this topic again and again when we're looking at books that deal with refugees. There are clear, easily comprehensible reasons. And if any of us lived there, we'd want to leave as well. Yes, I wanted to move away from just the factual level and think in literary terms. You can't misunderstand this book when you read it. Then it's shot through with so much empathy. And if you don't sense the empathy in the book, I don't know what you read. Well, sometimes I struggled when I was translating with the first-person narrator. I felt she exuded a great deal of hardness, and she was very condescending sometimes, almost patronizing and judging. Well, most of the reviews I've read write about the book almost as if it was a novella, and they write about it as if they really write about this rough moment of the attack with the bottle, this failure, allegedly, of female empowerment and failing to arrive in white society and to really live there. And that engagement with the female first-person narrator, which is vital for this novel, as always something that's not really addressed in the reviews. I find it strange. Yes, very little is actually written about this very particular first-person narrator who transports the fury outwards. And this whole narrative strand. About feeling that her body is almost impinged upon by these stories. There's nowhere to run to, no safe refuge, because these stories are encroaching in upon her, almost physically. But it's very important to understand this as an interpreter. And you have to think about the working conditions of interpreters. You don't get paid properly for that kind of interpreting. And are under a lot of pressure socially, and work without any supervision in situations where people are constantly telling very difficult stories. So the question really is, what kind of first-person narrator is this? What's her social position within society? There's this huge conflict between those who have a voice and those who have no voice. But she's presented as the one who always reproduces the words of others again and again without having her own voice. Yes, but she tries then at the physical level that we were just talking about to conquer that back again by inverting the gender relationship and consciously and provocatively abandoning herself to men.
So I have a final question that aims into the center of the profession and of the experience that led to this book. Scenes keep recurring where the narrator is being accused by the asylum seekers that the translation is not correct. When a lawyer asks her expressly to translate in a way that is more effective, that the stories become more effective. So the interpretation process is put in doubt. What does that do to your translation, to your work as an interpreter? I think you have a lot of autobiographical experience in the book. What did this cause in you? Well, I have to say, first of all, when I write the novel, I don't try to be nice or not nice. That is not my role. I don't care about being nice, not in real life, but as a writer. And I don't want to create pretty things. I want to create the truth. And when you look for truth, you have to go straight ahead like an arrow and not to censor yourself and not have the weight of a moralizing look on you that says, this is the narrative. I'm a narrator. The narrator and the author often overlap in the novel. And the system of political asylum is a system where the asylum seekers are reduced to being a simple number. And I give them a voice and a face, and I give them a second chance to survive in this area, in this narrative zone. Literature for me is necessary, wonderful. It's a wonderful perversion of reality. My novels are anchored in reality and inspired by it. But I think since my childhood, I've always had a perverted viewpoint of the reality. I can't write a normal sentence. It's always complicated and a trick sentence. I don't mean in the erotic or scandalous sense. I just mean that the reality is somewhat warped. And the novels don't judge the narrator if he's kind or nice or not. The important thing is that not out of generosity, but out of necessity, the narrator had enough space. It's important for me because I came from a colonialized country in 47, Bangladesh and India split up, and there has been a conflictual relationship between the two countries for 70 years now. Also between men and women, Hindu and Muslims, and fundamentalism, fanaticism. And I think when somebody is in like a closed box of interpretation and face to face with the person that you interpret, there are several layers of tension that operate between an Indian and woman and man, between different social classes. I'm not going to repeat all of this once more, but the political conscience belongs to the richer classes. And what I want social conscience to permeate all the layers of the society. And now I've forgotten your question. It was, yes, about the what does interpretation do to you. I wrote this novel because the situation was unbearable for me. And today, I think even after everything that has been happening in the last 5 years in Europe, in Germany, and in France, I don't think that I would have censored myself from writing this text. I think the role of my novel aims at its target. And that was the author's last word.